You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
I'll start by telling you how I came to write the book. As was mentioned, I was the co-president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War and had been active in the peace movement as a speaker and writer for more than 20 years. And New Society Publishers and Guy Dauncey approached me and said, would I be willing to write this book about positive signs in the development of peace around the world? And I was absolutely thrilled because I've been saving these stories for years and years. When I would see one of these little flashes of light, I'd think, oh, I need to hold on to that. I was still practicing, however, and I thought, I can't do this. It's too much, because I was still going out and speaking all the time against nuclear weapons. But eventually I thought, what can I do with my life that is the most valuable at this stage? And I decided to take early retirement and write the book to get it out there, because I have a sense that many of us are filled with despair and discouragement, that it seems as if the world is going from bad to worse, and I know we could all give lists of things that we see that are going to bring about the end of humanity, and most of us don't know all of these things that are happening on the other side. So I then contacted Guy and New Society and said, yes, I'm going to do this, and got down to doing the research. And I have to tell you that for the 2 years that it took, I was doing this wonderful balancing between going out and speaking about nuclear weapons and depleted uranium and all of these horrific weapons of mass destruction and the duplicity of government leaders and so on. And then I would come home and I would be researching the most amazing stories of the heights that can be reached by human beings who are committed to living a peaceful life with integrity. I'd like to just begin with a quotation from Patrick Tyler from the New York Times on February the 17th, 2003. You may remember that on February the 15th, we were all out marching all over the world, more than 15 million people, to object to the planned bombing of Iraq. And Tyler wrote, "The fracturing of the Western alliance over Iraq and the huge anti-war demonstrations around the world this weekend are reminders that there may still be two superpowers on the planet, the United States and world public opinion." I think it's not just world public opinion. It is, in fact, civil society. And by civil society, I mean all of those people in various different organizations, nonprofit organizations, who are not working for government or the military or representing big corporations, but who are out there taking a stand based on conscience. And in fact, there's a book over there by Nicanor Perlas that talks about the three pillars of society. And I've used some of his ideas, because one of the things that he says is that a society has three pillars: government, the economy or the business sector, and civil society. All three are needed, and for many years we've had this kind of dysfunctional enmeshing of government and big business without the voice of civil society being heard. And now we are at the time when the voice of civil society is coming forward. Civil society brings the conscience to the actions and decisions of government and big business, and that is why we are so important. I want to talk just a little bit about how important civil society is, because over the past, well, if we go back to when the United Nations was founded, we can say over the past 60 years or a bit more, and see the growth of civil society, but I look more to the past 10 years, during which time we've seen a huge increase in the number of people involved in all different countries, all over the world, in standing up and speaking out for justice and peace and equity and human rights and dignity. And this is a huge change for the world. Of course, we know that it's made possible because of the changes in transportation and communication that we can now be in touch with people all over the world. And an event that takes place in the Philippines is reported to us, and we can take action in Vancouver within hours or days. So all of these things are extremely important. At the United Nations, the number of civil society organizations has grown from a handful when the organization was founded to something over 47,000 now that are accredited. And those organizations actually go to the United Nations, they take part in conferences there, they advise governments, and believe me, the documents provided by civil society are highly valued by governments. I'm speaking about documents, and I'll just give you an example from being at the UN for the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review meeting in the year 2000. The civil society organizations had all of their documents set out on tables in the corridor at the UN. And as the diplomats arrived to begin the day, they would all go, or they would send their secretaries, and pick up all of this documentation because it was their only source of information that was unbiased by national governments. It gave the actual voice of experts from civil society and from ordinary people. Now, I don't want to give the impression that everything is fine with the world. Certainly, I wouldn't still be working on the issues of disarmament and peace if I thought that it was clear sailing from here on in. It is not. The world is awash in weapons, not just nuclear weapons, of which there are still 28,000, but also other weapons of mass destruction and more that are under design at this present time. Even small arms and light weapons are still a very, very serious problem worldwide. You know and I know how unstable the world is, and that there is now a threat of yet another war, an attack on Iran. We know that we have to stop this. We know that we have to change the way that the world is dealing with conflict, because all of us are aware, and in this room I'm sure, that global warming, climate change, pollution, overpopulation are issues that we cannot address if we are using all of our resources for destruction instead of to learn to work together. So I am not going to spend a lot of time creating fear or talking about protest against all of these terrible things, but I do want to acknowledge we're not looking at sweetness and light here. We're looking at examples where ordinary people have taken action that has either prevented violent conflict or brought it to an end. And some of the examples that I give are maybe examples that only lasted for a short time, and I give them even though they didn't last. I give them because they give ideas of further refinements that probably would work better and last longer. And some of them are ideas that people are raising that I think show enormous promise. So they are not solutions that have been tested, although most of them are examples that have been tested. So before I go any further, I want to ask you if you would be willing to do an exercise with me. And you don't have to do this. If you want to just sit there, you can just sit there. But if you're willing to do this, what I would like you to do is get up out of your seat. And if you think that we will never get rid of war, I want you to stand along this side. And if you think that maybe in the lifetime of my new little granddaughter, who just had her first birthday, if you think that in her lifetime, and let's assume she's going to live to be 80 years old or however, 70 or 80 years old, if you think that in her lifetime we will see the end to war, I'd like you to stand on this side. And then you can assort yourselves in the middle according to how close you feel to those guys and how close you feel to these guys. You willing to do that? Just those of you who will, come on up. Oh, 300 years, you'll be somewhere in the middle here, I guess.
About the next five.
The next five? That's pretty optimistic. You'd be pretty way far, over. Way over, way over. Okay. Okay, if you think we will never, ever get rid of war, you go way over there to the far end. If you think we will see the end of war within about 70 years, you go over there. And you kind of assort yourselves in the middle to just say approximately where you're standing. Okay. Does anyone want to say anything? No, you don't. Okay. Well, about where they're standing and what they... Over there. Yes.
I believe we will.
You believe we will.
You have to believe
we will. Thank you. Okay. What I wanted to point out, you could go and sit back down again. Thank you very much for being willing to stand up. I just want to tell you that I've done this about 10 different times with audiences that have ranged from religious organizations to groups of doctors who are working for peace, and to a very large audience of about 350 doctors and medical students. And the audiences vary, but in general, it's about 90% of people who think that we will never bring about peace, and the people are quite embarrassed to say that because here they're working in the peace movement to try to get rid of war, and about 10% are over here. But the interesting thing is that with the young people, there are far more over here. There are far more of them that think that we're on the path to getting rid of war as a means of resolving conflict. So I find that really interesting. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit about where we are in the world right now. So again, I'm going to ask you to embarrass yourselves by indicating what you think. How many of you think that there are, since the end of the Cold War in 1992, how many of you think that the number of major wars and genocides in the world has gone up? And if you think up, I want you to do this, and if you think down, I want you to do this. Okay, how many think up? Okay, how many think down? Okay, you haven't read the book yet. The actual fact, and this comes from the Lew Center at the University of British Columbia in the report called Human Security that came out last November, the Lew Center reports that major wars and genocides are down by 80% since the end of the Cold War. So, okay, we get another chance. How many of you think that the number of wars in general, smaller wars and so on included, is up? Put your hands up and down like this if you think they've gone down. How many think up? Okay, how many think down? Okay, and hold your thought for a minute. Look back to when Ferdinand Marcos was toppled. That was 1986 in the Philippines, the dictator, Hitler of the East, toppled by a velvet revolution. Following that, we saw the toppling of the Berlin Wall, and after that, all of those dictators in Eastern Europe, starting with Eastern Germany, and then one after another, Romania, Bulgaria, Latvia, the Soviet republics, Chile, Argentina, the dictators have been overturned. How many dictators do you think have been toppled non-violently since 1986? I'll tell you, I thought 19. I counted up the ones I could think of. I thought 19. Sounds about right. Any other guesses? 60 dictators have been... In other words, if we want to do regime change, we know how to do it non-violently. We don't have to bomb and kill 100,000 people. We know how to bring about regime change. And we know how to bring it about in such a way that a country can be left with a fledgling democracy, a struggling democracy, I grant you, and a democracy that may not survive in with ethical elections and so on without a huge amount of work. But then neither will our democracy survive without a lot of work, without a lot of participation. In fact, I think the number is now 61. Dictators who have been toppled, because I'm counting in the king of Nepal. My Nepalese friends tell me, yes, we're pretty sure that we now have democracy on a firm footing, but then in the last week or two, there's been some question about whether that peace is going to hold there. So we'll maybe call it 60 brackets 61 dictators who have been toppled. In other words, We need to look at the successes that we have brought about in the world in terms of not using war as the means to resolve conflict. The Human Security Center attributes this change to three things: the United Nations and its successes, the growth of international law, and in particular, they single out the development of the International Criminal Court, the founding of that court, which means that a leader can be held personally responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity. That's a big, big change. And the third factor is the growth of the power and influence of civil society. So that is us. And one of the things that I like to tell my audiences, especially in the United States, is we need to take credit for what change is happening in the world. Because as I began to research this book, I was blown away by the number of examples of nonviolent success stories. And I thought to myself as I did the writing, there is a revolution going on here, and we're not noticing it. And it wasn't really until I got the paper from the Human Security Center that I said, yes, they have found the same thing that I have found, and they've done it through a different path of research. There is a revolution happening, and we are part of it, and we need to look at how do we make this work now? How do we make this revolution even more successful? So I want to tell you a few of the ways that we can do it. In the book, I talk about actions that can be taken by individuals, by activists, by women, children, educators, church groups, by nation states, by the legal system, by artists and musicians and dancers, and by the United Nations and so on. So I want to give you a couple of really dramatic examples. And then I'll tell some stories with smaller examples, but let me give you some of the big ones first. One of the big ones was the Landmines Treaty. The Landmines Treaty came about as a result of a civil society initiative. A group of non-governmental organizations met in 1993 in London in the UK in a convent, and I happened to be there representing the International Physicians Group. And there were 50 people. And this convent, I'm telling you, was really basic. It cost £30 a night, and that included three meals. So you can guess just how basic it was. We met there for 3 days, and we heard from experts, surgeons who dealt with landmine injuries, people who go out into the field to do demining, those very courageous people who go out with a device that looks like a penknife. And they lie down with their masks over their faces and put this in every 2 centimeters to find if there's a tripwire there or if there is something that they can detect that would lead them to suspect that there's a landmine. We heard from them. We heard from people who were experts at working with government and finding the sympathetic ears in government and who might be worth addressing the question of landmines with. We heard from the International Committee of the Red Cross. And on the third day, people simply took up tasks. And they said, okay, I will provide the photographs of landmines victims from the surgical point of view. And someone else said, I will provide stories of victims in Cambodia or in Mozambique. And someone else said, I will provide information about rehabilitation, and all of this was coordinated then through Jody Williams and the Vietnam Veterans of America. And the result was this vast network of people all working entirely separately, but working extraordinarily effectively to share information. And by 1996, Lloyd Axworthy was on board. Princess Diana had come on board and given a huge push to the campaign by her influence. Lloyd Axworthy said, it's time to hold a meeting of like-minded states to see, let's talk about how we might develop a treaty to ban landmines. And then a year later, in 1997, that treaty was signed, and it was an enormous triumph. some of the funny stories that came out at the end as they were drafting the treaty and they were in Norway. We got messages on our email saying that the United States was holding out. First of all, the United States refused to take part in the negotiations, and then when they saw the treaty was going to go ahead anyway without them, they suddenly came and said, well, yes, we would support this treaty, except that the United States must be the exception. We must be allowed to have landmines on the border between North and South Korea, and we want a statement that says landmines are not legal except in time of war. That's really true. That's really true. Anyway, people all over the world were sitting at their fax machines, as I was, cranking out these letters and sending them off to Norway to say, hold firm, don't cave in. Do not make this a weak treaty. No matter what, do not water this treaty down. It was not watered down. It's a great treaty, and it's a huge step forward. The one regret I think everyone has is that cluster bombs were not included in that treaty, and it simply was not possible, and now we still have to work to get those bombs banned because they act like millions of small landmines. At any rate, that was an example where civil society and government worked together in a very positive campaign, in a very synergistic way, and to huge success. Another example was the example of taking nuclear weapons to court. In this case, the story begins in New Zealand, where a group of lawyers and a couple of doctors got together with a magistrate, and the magistrate said, you know, it seems to me that if dum-dum bullets are against international law, then surely nuclear weapons must be illegal. And the lawyers said, well, of course that makes sense, but it doesn't make any difference, because unless the International Court of Justice, known also as the World Court, unless the World Court makes a statement that nuclear weapons are not legal under international law, it doesn't matter to anybody. There's no point in saying it. So this group said, well, let's start a campaign to get the World Court to look at this question and give us a ruling. But ordinary people like us are not allowed to approach the court and ask them to please rule on this particular question. So what had to happen was either a UN agency like the WHO or other UN agencies would have to take this question forward, or a nation state. And so there was huge work done to get various different countries to be the one that would come forward and bring this to the floor of the General Assembly. And the non-aligned movement was the source, finally, that brought it to the UN General Assembly. And after much, heartache, I suppose, is heartache and struggle, the General Assembly did ask for this opinion to be requested from the World Court. But I just want to tell you that while all the wrangling was going on, I remember the Swedish foreign minister saying to us that the nuclear weapon states were putting enormous pressure on all the other countries to say, do not send this request to the World Court. And she said it had got to the stage of breaking kneecaps. But still, the rest of the world held out against the nuclear weapon states. It did go to the World Court, and the World Court issued a very interesting statement saying nuclear weapons are, in general, contrary to international law. But there was one case that they couldn't rule upon, because the High Court can only rule if there's already been a law established. And the case that they couldn't comment on would be if the very existence of a nation state were threatened. And they said, in that case, we cannot rule. We can't say. But at the same time, they said, if a nuclear weapon were ever to be used, it would have to comply with international humanitarian law. And that means it could not cause environmental devastation, death of civilians and innocent people or the destruction of a food supply. So it'd be pretty hard to imagine how you would use a nuclear weapon. So those were two cases where civil society began the actions, and in fact, the nation states took up those actions rather quickly, I would say, in 4 or 5 years, bringing those campaigns to fruition. The most recent one was the establishment of the International Criminal Court, and I've written about it in the book, and the comment by one of the leading people who said that he thought it would take 99 years before they would ever get it through, and instead it was 3 or 4 years before it actually was passed and established. So those are some of the huge triumphs. And I'd like to talk just briefly about some of the powerful stories that are on a smaller scale. And I'd like to talk first about women and the women of Argentina. Just take 1 second to find these. Maybe not going to find it here. Here we are. In Argentina, dictatorship, the military regime, had caused more than 30,000 people to disappear. In other words, they were stolen away from their families and tortured and murdered, and their remains were, the location of their remains were unknown, so they were known as the disappeared. It was worth your life to protest against that regime. But a small group of women, clothed in black and led by a woman named Estella Carlotto, refused to be intimidated by the death squads. They went and stood in the center of the city, in the Plaza de Mayo, in silent witness with photographs of their loved ones who had disappeared, asking for information, simply stood there giving silent witness. Gradually, over a period of time, the numbers of these women grew and grew, and they began to wear on their heads white scarves that represented the diapers of the children that they had lost now to the death squads. And they said their whole lives were committed to this. They were not leaving. Their silent protest, first of all, led to many of them being tortured, some being killed. Many times they were imprisoned and beaten, but they continued to come back, and more women replaced them. And what happened was they gave courage to the rest of the society, and the rest of the society began to object in other different ways until eventually that dictatorship was toppled. Today, Women in Black is a worldwide organization, and they protest against injustices in many different countries. And in particular, you can look up their work between Israeli and Palestinian groups, where the women come together to call for justice and equity and a resolution of the conflict in the Middle East according to a set of principles, which probably many of you already know. These are really important witnesses because they show that people without arms are able to stand up for justice, and other people are inspired by that, and most of the time those people are not killed. The people taking this action are not killed. Of course, they're always taking the chance that they will be. Second example I want to give is one about peace education. I taught university students in the Faculty of Education for 5 years. I taught them about violence prevention in schools. And one of the things that I talked about was peace education and the importance of young people learning alternative ways to resolve conflict and learning how to communicate with each other in nonviolent ways and so on. And I have to confess to you that in the back of my mind, I sometimes thought, I wonder if this really works. I wonder if I am just talking hopefully, but in fact, maybe kids don't change. Maybe it's like Sunday school, that we sort of listened to all of these stories and then dismissed them as we got into our teenage years. Well, here's the story that convinced me that, in fact, it does make a huge difference. This is a story of Lucknow, India. In India, there's a site near Lucknow, which was in the city of Ayodhya. I'm just checking that I don't get these groups incorrect as I'm telling you this. It's recognized by the Hindus as Lord Rama's birthplace, but it was also the site of a sacred Muslim mosque. And in 1992, the mosque was destroyed by Hindu extremists who literally not only toppled it and bashed it down, but took every brick apart. And the result was riots all over India, and some 3,000 people were killed and communities were devastated, and many people were left homeless because their houses were burned down. But Lucknow, which was very close to Ayodhya, did not have violence, or if it did, it had very minor examples of violence. And the reason was that Lucknow is the home of a very special school that had been founded in 1959. It's a Montessori school. It's called the City Montessori School. And it was founded on Gandhian principles by a young couple who believed that children should learn not only the normal academic subjects and learn them with excellence, but that they also should be learning the teachings of Gandhi and practicing them in their own lives. Over the years, the City Montessori School grew until, by the time of this incident in Ayodhya, over 250,000 students had passed through the system. The system now has students on 22 campuses and about 29,000 students in all of these different schools in total. So that's a large part of the population who had been educated in nonviolent principles. So on the day that the news came out about this terrible destruction of the temple and the incitement of violence, the city magistrate called together the leaders of all of the religious groups in the city, along with the leaders from the Montessori school, and said, okay, how are we going to prevent our city from breaking down into violence? And they said, well, we're going to meet twice a day with our own religious communities to pray and to talk about the fact that the God of the Muslims and the God of the Hindus is one God, and it is not necessary for us to fight one another about how we worship. They then had children on those little jeeps with loudspeakers out the sides, and the children would speak to the people and say, we don't have to use violence, we can work through our conflicts with each other. And tens of thousands of people walking in the streets day after day, and after 2 weeks, everything had simmered down. So it's quite an example of the power of having taught this large number of people so that you were now into probably the third generation, I guess, of children going through this same system and thinking and using the same kind of language. So that's one that has always given me a lot of hope. I did land mines. Reclaiming democracy is one of the others that I find is really inspiring. When you hear about some of the election fraud that has gone on in many, many different countries, not just the United States, but many other countries, and you think the United States is the kind of shining example of what a democracy should be, and yet at this time in history it's being corrupted, and we're seeing probable widespread vote fraud in the last two elections. But what gives me hope is the response of people right across the country to reclaim their democracy and to demand a clean vote chain. Clean vote chain is my term, but I apply it to all of the different actions that are being taken, right from registering people and making sure that everyone who is eligible does get registered, all the way through to ensuring that the campaigning is done without undue influence by big money, and I must say that's still a huge, huge obstacle, on to making sure that the votes actually are being recorded, that the votes are then being counted, that the counting is then being reported accurately, and that the whole process from beginning to end is transparent and can be held, that people can be held accountable at every level. It's really exciting to see some of these changes happening in different states, and in particular in the Eastern Seaboard of the U.S., there have been initiatives in communities where the people have said, if candidates agree not to accept corporate donations, then the public purse will fund the campaigns for those candidates. And where those people have been elected, there have been changes such as beginning to bring in universal health care in communities I think it's Vermont and Rhode Island, but don't quote me on that. I'd have to check out my own data. But finally, some changes where the influence of money is being pushed aside in the interests of democracy. A couple of other lovely stories. One of them is about Bogota, Colombia. And whenever I think of Bogota, or whenever I think of Colombia, I think of the drug trade and terrible, terrible violence. Well, in fact, there have been huge changes in Bogota in the past 10 or 12 years because they've had a series of mayors who have been enormously creative. One of them was a guy named Antanas Mockus, who was a math professor, but he decided in his early 50s that there was a greater need for him to go and do something more important than just teach mathematics at the university, where he was a well-loved teacher. So he ran for mayor, and when he was elected, he came out into the city wearing a Superman costume, and he called himself Super Citizen. He started out by showing what good citizens do, and he had mime artists, pantomime artists, all dressed up in costume, and they would mime, and he would help them. They would mime how you pick up trash and put it in the garbage. So one guy would be the garbage, and another one would come and mime putting in the garbage. And when people jaywalked, the mime artist would walk along behind them, copying their movements, and everyone would start to laugh, and people stopped jaywalking. There was a water shortage, so he went on television having a shower and turned off the turned off the water to demonstrate that you can soap yourself down and then turn the water on again. Water consumption dropped by 40%. He replaced the corrupt officials on the transit system, the transit police, with mime artists, and the crime rate dropped on the transit system and people began to use it. They then, under the next mayor, put in something like 7,000 kilometers of bicycle and walking paths. They said they wanted to restore the dignity of the poor. And the way to do that, although they couldn't afford to put up new apartment blocks and beautify their living spaces, what they could do was make the surroundings more beautiful. And so they put in parks and bikeways. They made a fabulous transportation system that is very low cost, so that the poor were no longer treated as trash in the streets. One of the mayors said that he was concerned because women were not safe downtown in the evenings, that they would likely be mugged, as even by gangs of children. So he declared three nights that would be women's night in the downtown. And he said, I want all of the men to stay at home and look after the children, and the women to come down, and there will be jazz bands, and there will be cafes, and so on. And the women have the run of the city. Well, some of the men objected and said, it's not fair, we have business, we have to be downtown. And he said, oh, I never meant that you couldn't go downtown. I meant that it would be wonderful if you wanted to stay at home with the children and the wives could come downtown. If you have to be downtown, write yourself out a certificate of safe passage and go ahead and come downtown. 700,000 women went into the downtown on those three nights. When women are back on the streets, what happens is the community becomes gentler. Violence in Bogota has dropped to such an extent that the New York Times reported that it was now safer than Baltimore. So it is possible, with a lot of creative thinking, to change our culture, and that's really what we're talking about. Reform the United Nations is another task that is very important. I think we do have to get rid of the veto. We have to bring genuine democracy into the United Nations. And as we are looking at the issues of resource depletion and competition for oil, how we are going to share the resources of the world in an equitable way without violence, I think we will have to depend upon the UN or whatever it evolves into to make the world a safe place for everyone, a place where everyone can survive. I just want to finish with one little story before I take questions. In 1989, I think it was, in the Soviet Union, they were still testing their nuclear weapons at in Kazakhstan. And a poet there, Olgas Suleymanov, had really had enough because the whole area was contaminated. There were birth defects in the babies being born there, and the people were suffering from long-term exposure to low-level radiation. So he called an international conference to object to the Soviet testing out at that range in Semipalatinsk, in a place called Karaul. Well, about 600 people came from outside. 300 were doctors, 150 were doctors. 300 came from overseas, and the other 300 came from throughout Kazakhstan and the rest of the Soviet Union. And I went to that meeting. It was an extraordinary thing because for the very first time, instead of hearing the Soviets saying these speeches, "We Soviets are a peace-loving people," da-da-da-da-da, the Kazakh tribesmen were jumping up and grabbing the microphone and screaming into the microphone, "Let the generals build their summer dashes on the test range. We have had enough." And the dynamism of the meeting was simply breathtaking. Gorbachev responded by saying that if the Americans gave that much pressure to the American president, there would be a complete test ban treaty immediately. They did put in a moratorium, and they have not tested since as a result of that that protest. But I wanted to tell you the story of the final night of the protest, because this is one of the images in my mind of sort of my peak experience in working toward peace and disarmament. We were being hosted in little yurts, you know, those little round tents. Well, they're lined with beautiful carpets on the inside. And because there were about 600 people that they were hosting, they had 30 yurts and 20 people inside each one to host in the center, and this incredible spread of food, just absolutely gorgeous food. Reminds me most of Middle Eastern food, but horse meat and vegetables and pomegranates and vodka and, you know, everything, and horse milk, in fact, mixed with blood that was passed around for us to drink. It was an extraordinary feast, and the host asked the eldest person in the group to propose a toast. And he said, "We look to the eldest person to give his wisdom and his life experience and to impart that to us in this toast." So the eldest person was a Swedish doctor who was in his 80s, and he was so embarrassed. He was very hard of hearing, and he was so embarrassed when he was asked to do this that he simply said, "Peace and health," and drank his vodka, and the host went, "No, no, no, no." And he was explaining this to me because he had to translate. He only spoke Kazakh, and the translator only spoke Kazakh and French. And I was the only person who spoke French badly, who spoke French and English. So I was the third person giving this message. And he said, "No, no, 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 no. The person giving this toast is giving us his wisdom, I mean, his whole life, and we need to learn from this. That's why we look to our elders, and we need a much deeper message than this." And Mary, they call me Mary, not Mary, "and Mary, now we'd like to hear from your wisdom as a doctor. We'd like to hear a toast from you." And I was just dumbfounded to think, what am I going to say? So I started out by saying something a little bit innocuous, and he was shaking his head like this. So finally I said, you know, I think of myself delivering babies, and I have to imagine how it would be to be here in Kazakhstan delivering a baby, not knowing about the state of that baby, how healthy it would be, and especially not knowing about that baby's future. It must be a really devastating experience to be in a delivery, and instead of all of the high hopes that we have for healthy babies, having this tension and sense of despair. Well, he reached out and he took my hand between his and he said, Mary, you are my brother. Now, I wrote that in the book, but I said, Mary, you are my family, because I don't want to make fun of this man. So in my book, it says, you are my family, but you know the real story. Anyway, after that, he said, now you're all going to sing for me. He said, well, what are we going to sing? Because we were a group of Japanese and Swedes and Germans and Africans and Americans, and, you know, what were we going to sing? And he said, We Shall Overcome. So everyone sang We Shall Overcome in their own language. And I could only think about that spy satellite, you know, from the Americans circling over this test range and looking down on this little circle of lighted yurts out in the desert. And I wish that it could have heard We Shall Overcome being sung in all these different languages. I think it would have been such an important message for the satellite.